Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1163. Farewell America, part 2. This is being recorded on November 17th of the year 2020. The title of this program is taken from an enigmatic and somewhat oblique book that appears to have been published by French intelligence in 1968. It is about the assassination of JFK, which, as we saw in our last program, was inextricably linked with a CIA-assisted attempt at ousting former French president and World War II French resistance leader, Charles de Gaulle, or Free French leader, Charles de Gaulle. This was in the early 1960s. And probably because of that, French intel, publishing under the name of, quote, James Hepburn, unquote, published that enigmatic Farewell America. There has been a lot of discussion about the 2020 election and so many things, from Donald Trump personally to his campaigns and elements of the GOP's efforts, somewhat successfully, to discredit the validity of the election process in the minds of many. And there has been much self-righteous beating of the breast and bloviation by elements of the mainstream media and our political establishment about how this threatens slash tarnishes American democracy. As we saw, well, as we have really seen in so many programs over the decades, American democracy is in its fundament long gone. It had its brains blown all over the back of a limousine in broad daylight in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963. And many things, including the Vietnam War, came out of that, as we have looked at in many programs. Among the reasons that JFK was killed was because he was pulling out the U.S. from Vietnam. NSA 263 basically took care of that, and that was in October of 1963, and then 2 days after Kennedy was killed, that withdrawal was canceled, and the whole show went on, as we have seen in so many programs. So, by way of taking a look at how America really bad farewell to the world of democracy, we are going to resume, before we get back to the subject of the COVID-19 op, we are going to take a look back at some of the foundations of American fascism. I was struck by the manifestations of American fascism in the post-1963 world. I was struck by a full-page ad on page A11 of the Western edition of the New York Times of Monday, November 9th of 2020. It says, "A pledge to all the people of the world, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. The Trump-Pence regime must go," and so on and so forth. And among the names at the bottom, most of them I did not recognize. Some of them were Hollywood celebrities. I don't watch TV and rarely go to the movies, so maybe more than what I had just recognized. But two of the very first names that were on this list, one was a guy named Cornel West, who was a member of the Bernie Sanders Institute, and an individual whom I heard on a Pacifica radio broadcast. In fact, it was Amy Goodman's Democracy Now. And shortly after the Democratic Convention in 2016, Cornel West was saying that, well, Brother Bernie didn't get everything he wanted in the convention. Basically, you never do in politics. And so for that reason, we, meaning Cornel West and his fellow Bernie Sanders supporters had no choice but to vote for Jill Stein of the Green Party. I think it is grotesque and would be ironically funny, but I think it is more grotesque that a mere 4 years plus later, Cornel West is saying, we cannot accept fascism, and there are all sorts of things they cannot accept. If Cornel West did not have his head lodged securely between his buttocks in 2016, he would have recognized what was at stake in the 2016 election. I'm not a big fan of Hillary Clinton, and an awful lot of the people I have voted for in presidential politics for a long time, really since I began studying the JFK assassination in the early 1970s, my basic operational dynamic as far as voting is triage, trying to prevent as much damage and bleeding as possible. But what really struck me was the second signatory to this ad. This is, the ad was taken up by refusefascism.org. Number two on the list is none other than Noam Chomsky, a icon of the left. Noam Chomsky, when the JFK movie came out in 1991, sparking a wave of re-interest in the JFK assassination, Noam Chomsky splashed cold water on any notion, really, that there was a conspiratorial process behind and underlying JFK's killing, and even perhaps more importantly, that there is no indication that JFK was pulling us out of Vietnam. There have been many, many books talking about that. John Newman's JFK in Vietnam, Peter Dale Scott's The War Conspiracy, book Destiny Betrayed by Jim Buggemio, James Douglas, JFK and the Unspeakable, and others have chronicled beyond the point of an intelligent doubt that, in fact, Kennedy was pulling us out of Vietnam. Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty wrote a book called JFK and Vietnam. I believe that's the title. I'm operating from memory. But talking in detail about how he had been involved in drawing up the plans to withdraw the U.S. from Vietnam and how those were overturned in the immediate aftermath of JFK's assassination. With his Pied Piper Act leading the children of the left down the primrose path into falsehood, Noam Chomsky, I believe, did a terrible, terrible disservice, not only to history, but to the American political process. I have noted in the past that Noam Chomsky, in fact, has considerable gravitas with regard to the very interests he professes us he opposes. What made his name as an academician was his work on generative linguistics. That work was financed by Naval Intelligence and Air Force Intelligence, and Chomsky really does not make any bones about that. He doesn't deny that. He just says, quote, well, it's all alienated labor, unquote. And perhaps when denying the obvious, which is that JFK was in fact pulling us out of Vietnam, and that was among the reasons he was killed, perhaps Noam Chomsky was simply manifesting the old adage, it is very difficult to get someone to believe something when keeping their job depends on their not believing it or understanding it. In that very same issue of the New York Times, the November 9th, 2020 issue of the New York Times, on the back page of the front section, there was an obituary by Robert B. McFadden, Seymour Topping, 98, former Times journalist and witness to history, dies. And this is about Seymour Topping, and he was, among other things, skipping down in this a bit, as Southeast Asia bureau chief from 1963 to 1966, he covered the early American military involvement in Vietnam and wars in Laos and Cambodia. and indeed it was the New York Times that published the untenable Warren Report, which has become the acceptable historical record of the JFK assassination to date. So with Noam Chomsky, who helps to Deep Six interest in JFK in Vietnam after the Oliver Stone movie JFK came out, and with the obit of Seymour Topping, who was Southeast Asia bureau chief from 1963 to 1966, we have something of a grotesque pair of journalistic bookends for, well, really the theme of this program, Farewell, America. I recall how during the Vietnam War and when the anti-Vietnam War movement was in full swing, I remember the cry on the part of many of the anti-Vietnam War protesters, bring the war home, unquote. Well, that is a textbook example of be careful what you wish for because you might get it. We are going to take a look at a very, very important book, and for the record, 1085. It was my privilege to interview the author, Tom O'Neill, of the book Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s, published in 2019 by Little Brown. And this is, again, a very important book. I cannot recommend strongly enough that people buy the book, read it, tell other people about it. Perhaps as the holiday gift-giving season is upon us, this would make an excellent holiday gift for someone you know that is interested in history and in truth. Tom O'Neill makes a very strong, albeit circumstantial, case that, in fact, the Manson family was a domestic, and their killings was a domestic intelligence operation, one of the manifestations of the CIA's Operation Chaos, a successful attempt at disrupting and neutralizing what was termed the New Left, unquote, at the time. And again, he makes, O'Neill makes a very strong, excellent, albeit circumstantial case that the Manson family was part of that Operation Chaos, and specifically an element of a domestic Phoenix program. The Phoenix program was an assassination program in Vietnam that was altogether bloody, and part of which involved performing atrocities that were then blamed on the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. And in For the Record 1085 and in a Food for Thought post, I talked about one of the veteran intelligence officers that intersected with the Manson family, a remarkable creature named Reeve Whitson, who had more connections than the switchboard in addition to being involved with the Manson family and having the Cielo Drive home of Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski under physical surveillance the night of the killings. He was involved with many things. He was a special advisor to the chairman of the board of Thiessen AG, networked very heavily with Otto Skorzeny, and again, just an amazing fellow and a very sinister fellow, albeit in some ways I suspect if one could look at the very end of his life, a tragic figure as well. In the book Chaos, again, by Tom O'Neill, subtitled Charles Manson, the CIA and the Secret History of the 60s, he talks about the LAPD, one of the most intelligence-connected domestic police forces in our country, and indications that the CIA's Operation Chaos and the FBI's COINTELPRO had involved the LAPD, and the Manson family may very well have been part of that. And in Chaos, Tom O'Neill writes, and again, please buy this book or read it at the very least. It's an excellent book. By the way, I get no money whatsoever from that statement. I have no financial skin in the game, so to speak. Tom O'Neill writes in Chaos. Knowing more about Chaos and COINTELPRO, I felt that men like Reeve Whitson were potentially much more common than I'd anticipated, always in peripheral, undefined roles. Part of the reason that Whitson seemed like such a wild card to me was that he appeared to have walked on the scene from nowhere, an outre, worldly man suddenly hobnobbing with the LAPD's top brass. I wanted others who fit that profile. To cover up an operation like Chaos, the agency needed friends in law enforcement, insiders who could make arrests, or just as important, not make arrests. The most promising but frustrating of my inquiries concerned an LAPD officer named William W. Herman, H-E-R-R-M-A-N-N. I could never connect him to Whitson or Manson, but he certainly fit the profile of someone who'd helped with counterintelligence actions. When I was deep in the weeds of my Chaos research, split between feeling that I was onto something or that I was risking my credibility, Herman's name was a name that came up several times, usually from sources I didn't quite trust or in arcane articles from the alternative press. What I heard about him was just plausible enough to get me to look closer. I'm glad I did. Herman's story hints at how intelligence agencies may have collaborated with police in Los Angeles. A longtime lieutenant with the LAPD, Herman had an unusual background for law enforcement. He had a doctorate in psychology. He specialized in quelling insurgencies. He developed one of the first computer systems to track criminals and predict violent outbreaks in cities. Daryl Gates, the head of the LAPD from 1978 to 1992, hailed him as a, quote, genius, unquote, praising his technical aptitude in particular. But Herman's work wasn't limited to Los Angeles or even to the U.S. My Freedom of Information Act request to the FBI yielded a collection of redacted documents detailing his extensive employment history. Concurrent with his time in the LAPD, he'd worked under contract for a dizzying list of American intelligence and military agencies, the Air Force, the Secret Service, the Treasury Department, the President's Office of Science and Technology, the Institute for Defense Analysis, the Defense Industrial Security Clearance Office, and the Defense Department's Advanced Research Projects Agency. Most of his work for these groups remains classified. You'd think these projects wouldn't have left much free time, but Herman piled on even more work, taking leaves of absence from the LAPD to pursue side gigs with defense firms. These had opaque, generic names like Electro-Optical Systems, System Development Corporation, and Control Data Corporation. This last, a weapons manufacturer in Minneapolis, relied on Herman's services for 10 years, from 1961 to 1971, or so Herman told the FBI. When the Bureau went to Control Data Corporation for a background check, the company claimed that Herman never worked for them. You might have guessed, given Herman's long list of government employers, I wondered if his work for these defense contractors could have been a front for the CIA, one of the few agencies that did not appear on his resume. As usual, official channels were useless. My Freedom of Information Act request to the CIA for Herman's records yielded the same, quote, neither confirm or deny, unquote, response that Reeve Whitson's had. I did find, however, a record of Herman's overseas work, much of which he conducted while still employed with the LAPD. Having spent 4 months in 1967 training Thai police in counterinsurgency tactics, Herman returned to Asia in September of 1968 to join the U.S. effort in South Vietnam. Documents from the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, listed him as a scientific, quote, advisor, unquote, to the Army. His responsibility was to train South Vietnam, Vietnamese police in paramilitary techniques, unquote, to deploy against Viet Cong insurgents. None of the records described those techniques in any detail, but the mere mention of them was enough to make me put a few things together. the dates of Herman's stint in Vietnam, his job description, his professional affiliations, and his training made it abundantly likely that he was working for a CIA project called Phoenix, one of the most controversial elements in the agency's history. Richard Nixon had secretly authorized Phoenix in 1968. It was discontinued in early 1971. The agency described it as, quote, a set of programs that sought to attack and destroy the political infrastructure of the Viet Cong, unquote. Inside Vietnam, Phoenix operatives waged a campaign of terror against the Viet Cong guerrillas, with tactics including the assassination and torture of non-combatant civilians. According to a 1971 congressional investigation, the program violated the codes of the Geneva Conventions and rivaled the Viet Cong's own terrorism in its mercilessness. During the Senate hearings, a number of Phoenix operatives admitted to massacring civilians and making it appear that the atrocities were the work of the Viet Cong. One more time. During the Senate hearings, a number of Phoenix operatives admitted to massacring civilians and making it appear that the atrocities were the work of the Viet Cong. Their hope was to win the hearts and minds, unquote, of neutral Vietnamese citizens, compelling them to turn away from the insurgency in revulsion. A Special Forces soldier, Anthony Herbert, H-E-R-B-E-R-T, the single most decorated combat veteran, beginning again, a Special Forces soldier, Anthony Herbert, the single most decorated combat veteran of Vietnam, published a best-selling book, Soldier, that detailed typical orders from his Phoenix superiors. Quote, they wanted me to take charge of execution teams that wiped out entire families and tried to make it appear as though the Viet Cong had done it themselves. The rationale was that the Viet Cong would see that other Viet Cong had killed their own and make allegiance with us, the good guys, unquote. Their attempts was sometimes even more unhinged. In 1968, CIA scientists at the Bien Hoa prison outside Saigon surgically opened the skulls of three prisoners, implanted electrodes on their brains, gave them daggers, and left them alone in a room. They wanted to shock the prisoners into killing one another. When the effort failed, the prisoners were shot and their bodies were burned. According to Seymour Hersh's 1972 book, Cover-Up, Phoenix had committees, unquote, set up across all 44 provinces in South Vietnam. They kept blacklists of Viet Cong fighters and had strict orders to meet weekly or monthly quotas of neutralizations, unquote. The whole operation relied on computerized indexes. The identity of its CIA leader never came to light, but whoever he was there ostensibly as part of the Agency for International Development, or USAID, later revealed as a CIA front. Herman, of course, was known for his aptitude with computers, and his time in Vietnam coincided almost exactly with Phoenix's operations. The papers I found at the National Archives confirmed that he was a part of USAID. I had no way to press him about any of this. He had died in 1993. As I had with Whitson, I wondered whether his family could tell me more about him. I found one of his daughters, Cindy, a dog breeder in Spokane, Washington. She invited me to see her. Only a teenager in the 60s, she didn't have many memories of her father's work, but she was confident that much of it had been top secret and that he had worked for the CIA. He never discussed his work with the family, not even her mother. She was instructed never to talk about her father with anyone, including extended family. She knew he did undercover work, both while he was with the LAPD and afterward. She showed me his passport. Visa stamps chronicled at least four trips to Vietnam between 1968 and 1970. Among his ID cards was one for, quote, the SWAT, not Vietnam Kong, HOA, unquote. She also shared several documents confirming Herman's participation in Phoenix. A framed memo from the U.S. Military Assistance Command, Vietnam, dated September 9, 1968, advised all personnel that Herman was, quote, a member of the Pacification Task Force working for Ambassador Comer. Comer, K-O-M-E-R, first name Robert, was nicknamed Blowtorch Bob for his take-no-prisoners approach to warfare. One more time. Comer, first name Robert, was nicknamed Blowtorch Bob, unquote, for his take-no-prisoners approach to warfare. He served 15 years in the CIA before arriving in Vietnam to work on Phoenix. According to Senate testimony, he was behind the program's notorious kill quotas. Even Herman's ephemera captivated me. Cindy had held onto a photo of dozens of men on an airplane captioned, bad guys, unquote, leaving a bad spot after having been bad, unquote. Once he returned from Vietnam, Herman retired from the LAPD after more than 20 years on the force, embarking on a series of, quote, research, unquote, gigs for various federal agencies, again, all top secret. With information from Cindy, a growing pile of press clippings, and the government documents I'd amassed, I tried to piece together Herman's post-retirement project. Whatever he learned in Southeast Asia, he brought it back to L.A. His work in California bore disturbing resemblances to the techniques he'd honed as part of the Phoenix Project. In 1968, California Governor Ronald Reagan appointed him to head a new riots and disorders task force dedicated to studying urban unrest and devising ways to prevent future outbreaks of violence. But in a 1970 interview, Herman revealed, maybe by accident, that the task force was hardly the research-based enterprise it claimed to be. Herman didn't give many interviews, but when he spoke to the London Observer's Charles Foley in May of 1970, he was apparently in a voluble mood. Discussing his work for the task force, he described a program of spying and infiltration far exceeding the, quote, studies, unquote, that the group was committed to. His words sounded as if they had been lifted from COINTELPRO and Chaos Manuals word for word. Both of these operations, of course, were well underway in Los Angeles at the time. Like Governor Reagan and President Johnson, Herman believed that California's student dissidents were funded by foreign communists. He told the Observer that he had a, quote, secret plan, unquote, for, quote, forestalling revolution in America, unquote. The key was, quote, to split off those bent on destroying the system from the mass of dissenters, then following classic guerrilla warfare theory to find means which will win their hearts and minds, unquote. He called this plan simply saving America, unquote, and it included strategies for, quote, deeper penetration by undercover agents into dissenting groups, unquote, such as army agents posing as students and news reporters, unquote. In a turn worthy of Minority Report, he wanted to use mathematical probability models to predict when and where violence would erupt. He also called for the use of long-range electronic surveillance devices if informants had already penetrated any dissenting groups, unquote, they would secretly record speeches and conversations, unquote. What that information would be used for and how, Herman didn't say. He spoke of the task force in the future tense, making it hard to discern how operational its saving America, unquote, tactics were. Whatever the case, his brazen claims generated backlash from the left. His daughter showed me a flyer from the Students for a Democratic Society depicting him as a pig. Maybe he felt he'd said too much, or maybe his superiors told him so, but a few months later, he gave another more circumspect interview. talking this time to the Sacramento Bee. He walked back some of his more chilling claims about saving America, unquote. Quote, Herman Bridles had an article in the London Observer, the reporter wrote, quoting Herman, the council could not set up a plan like that. We have a non-operational role. All we can do is review and fund projects suggested by local authorities, unquote. Saving America, unquote, sounded a lot like COINTELPRO, which sounded a lot like chaos. They all ran together in part, it seemed, because they all shared notes. In June of 2002, the San Francisco Chronicle published an investigative series detailing Governor Reagan's secret dealings with the CIA and the FBI, all part of his effort to halt what he construed as a communist-sponsored anti-war movement in California. The Chronicle revealed an internal FBI memo from July 1969 when Herbert Ellenwood, E-L-L-I-N-W-O-O-B, one of the governor's top advisors, visited FBI headquarters to discuss Reagan's plans for the, quote, destruction of disruptive elements on California campuses, unquote. As the Chronicle reported, Ellenwood asked the FBI for, quote, intelligence, unquote, information against protest groups. The FBI had secretly given the Reagan administration such assistance in the past, unquote. J. Edgar Hoover himself approved the request. The FBI suggested that the California state government might attack dissidents through a psychological warfare program. If that's what Reagan wanted, he didn't have to look far. In his own circle of advisors were Herman, the chairman of the Riots and Disorders Task Force, a veteran of Phoenix, and a man whose anti-leftist jives perfectly with the Reagan administration in Sacramento, to say nothing of the FBI's and the CIA's. And again, in the book, and I obviously read just that section, Tom O'Neill makes a good, albeit again, circumstantial case that the Manson family killings, thoroughly discredited, the so-called counterculture, were part of that. They also eliminated some key people. Tom O'Neill makes a good, although again, circumstantial case that the Manson family were in fact put together at the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, which to a considerable extent served as a CIA front. Not that it was exclusively a CIA front, but it did front for apparently some CIA domestic operations. The Manson operation, certainly Charles Manson, and many members of his so-called family were common visitors or patrons of the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, and a CIA MK-Ultra mind control veteran named Louis Jolyon West, J-O-L-Y-O-N West, whom we looked at in For the Record, AFA program number 28, among others, was also there at the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic. And again, it is Tom O'Neill's belief that he was involved with helping to program the Manson family at that clinic. Again, I'm telescoping a great deal in this very long and important book. I think, though, as we bid farewell to America, I got news for the refusefascism.org people. It went by the boards a long time ago. And with people like William Herman, the so-called progressive sector of the anti-war movement got their wish. They wanted the war to come home. Well, it sure as bloody hell did. They got a domestic Phoenix program. Louis Jolyon West was Jack Ruby's psychiatrist and told the Warren Commission that Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald because he had a brief psychomotor epileptic episode, which is really, it is original. Bearing in mind that we've taken a look at Jack Ruby's Warren Commission testimony in many programs, most recently in some of our For the Record series, recapping some of the AFA programs about mind control. Jolly West, Louis Jolyon West, was a key operative for the MK-Ultra mind control program, and in that regard worked with and corresponded with Sidney Gottlieb, G-O-T-T-L-E-I-B. Gottlieb most recently profiled in a recent book, was one of the prime movers in the CIA's MK-Ultra mind control programs, and Louis Jolyon West appears to have been one of his most effective operatives. We're going to begin taking a look here at Louis Jolyon West and his networking with Sidney Gottlieb and some of the things he was working on. And then we are going to take a look at a chilling episode. We'll conclude the program with this, and that is the apparent mind control of a U.S. Air Force man, airman named Jimmy Shaver, who appears to have been programmed to murder, mutilate, and rape a 3-year-old girl. More about that later. Of Louis Jolyon West and his networking with MK-Ultra and Sidney Gottlieb. So West really had lied all those years. Not only was he a part of MK-Ultra, he had corresponded with the black sorcerer, unquote, of MK-Ultra himself, a.k.a. Gottlieb, continuing with Tom O'Neill's Chaos. Preserved in his files, the letters picked up midstream with no prologue or preliminaries. The first one was dated June 11th, 1953, a mere 2 months after MK-Ultra started. West was then chief of psychiatric service at the air base at Lackland, Texas. Addressing Gottlieb as SG, he outlined the experiments he proposed to perform using a combination of psychotropic drugs and hypnosis. Enumerating short and long-term goals, he offered a 9-point list, beginning with a plan to discover, quote, the degree to which information can be extracted from presumably unwilling subjects through hypnosis alone or in combination with certain drugs, possibly with subsequent amnesia for the interrogation and or alteration of the subject's recollection of the information he formerly knew, unquote. Another item proposed, honing, quote, techniques for implanting false information into particular subjects or for inducing in them specific mental disorders, unquote. West wanted to reverse someone's belief system without his knowledge and make it stick. One more time. West wanted to reverse someone's belief system without his knowledge and make it stick. He hoped to create, quote, couriers, unquote, who would carry, quote, a long and complex message, unquote, embedded secretly in their minds, and to study, quote, the induction of trance states by drugs, unquote. All of these were the goals of MK-Ultra, and they bore a striking resemblance to Manson's accomplishments with his followers more than a decade later. Needless to say, West added, the experiments, quote, must eventually be put to test in practical trials in the field. West's colleagues wouldn't approve of his activities. He yearned to, quote, cut down considerably the number of people who can properly call me to account, unquote. Because he had been using drugs that were not on the Air Force list of standard preparations, unquote, he wanted to secure, quote, some sort of carte blanche, unquote. He would go on to suggest a number of security measures in his letters, including disguised funding, double envelopes, and false names. Next, West addressed a sensitive matter. Who would the guinea pigs be? He listed 4 groups, basic airmen, volunteers, patients, and, quote, others, possibly including prisoners in the local stockade, unquote. Only the volunteers would be paid. The others could be unwilling and, though it wasn't spelled out, unwitting. It would be easier to preserve his secrecy if he was inducing specific mental disorders, unquote, in people who already exhibited them. Again, quoting, certain patients requiring hypnosis and therapy or suffering from dissociative disorders, trances, fugues, amnesias, etc., might lend themselves to our experiments, unquote. As if to prove his thoroughness, he affixed two agenda to his four-page letter, begging Gottlieb to get one of his superiors, a Major Robert Williams, transferred to another base, unquote. Williams was, quote, an uncomfortably close scrutinizer of all my activities, unquote, who believed that hypnosis was tampering with the soul, unquote, West complained. Gottlieb's reply came on letterhead from Chemrophil Associates, unquote, a front company he used to correspond with MKUltra subcontractors. My good friend, he wrote, I have been wondering whether your apparent rapid and comprehensive grasp of our problems could possibly be real. You have indeed developed an admirably accurate picture of exactly what we were after. For this, I am deeply grateful. He would arrange top secret clearances for anyone who might become ensnared in their work, giving West, quote, a separate sum, unquote, for the purchase of materials. Gottlieb saluted his new recruit. We have developed quite an asset in the relationship we are developing with you, unquote. West returned the camaraderie, quote, it makes me very happy to realize that you consider me an asset, unquote, he replied, again quoting, surely there is no more vital undertaking conceivable in these times, unquote. With that, the record of their correspondence ceased for nearly 9 months. And that was in 1953. And again, Tom O'Neill talks about someone who appears to have been one of Jolly West's experimental guinea pigs, and that was an airman, an Air Force enlisted man named Jimmy Shaver, S-H-A-V-E-R, who raped and mutilated and killed a 3-year-old girl named Cher or Sherry C-H-E-R-E Joe Horton. And it appears that he was placed under mind control, very possibly to do the killing in the first place, or at the very least to have accepted responsibility for the killing, for a killing that he did not do. And as we will see, he had been treated at Lackland Air Force Base by Jolly West for severe migraines. And section of Tom O'Neill's Chaos, The Curious Case of Jimmy Shaver. Again, bearing in mind that the conversation, that the correspondence, I should say, between L. Jolly West and Sidney Gottlieb was interrupted for 9 months, beginning in 1953. That was before this. After midnight on July 4th, 1954, a 3-year-old girl named Sherry or Cher, C-H-E-R-E, Joe Horton, disappeared outside the Lackland Air Force Base where Jolly West was stationed. Horton's parents left her in the parking lot outside a bar. She played with her brother while they had a drink inside. When they noticed her missing, they formed a search party. Within an hour of Horton's disappearance, the party came up on a car with her underwear hanging from the door. They heard shouting nearby. Two construction workers had been napping in a nearby gravel pit when a Lackland airman wandered out of the darkness. He was shirtless, covered in blood and scratches. Making no attempt to escape, he let the search party walk into the edge of the highway. Bystanders described him as dazed, unquote, and trance-like, unquote. What's going on here? He asked. He didn't seem drunk, but he couldn't say where he was, how he'd gotten there, or whose blood was all over him. One more time. What's going on here? He asked. He didn't seem drunk, but he could not say where he was, how he had gotten there, or whose blood was all over him. Meanwhile, the search party found Horton's body in the gravel pit. Her neck was broken, her legs had been torn open, and she had been raped. Deputies arrested the man. His name was Jimmy Shaver, S-H-A-V-E-R, at 29. He was recently remarried with 2 children, no criminal record, and no history of violence. He'd been at the same bar Horton had been abducted from, but he had left with a friend who told police that neither of them was drunk, although Shaver seemed high on something. Before deputies could take Shaver to the county jail, a constable from another precinct arrived with orders from military police to assume custody of him. Around 4 that morning, an Air Force marshal questioned Shaver, and 2 doctors examined him, agreeing that he was not drunk. One later testified that he, quote, was not normal. He was very composed outside, which I did not expect him to be under these circumstances, unquote. He was released to the county jail and booked for rape and murder. Investigators interrogated Shaver through the morning. When his wife came to visit, he didn't recognize her. He gave his first statement at 10:30 a.m., adamant that another man was responsible. He could summon an image of a stranger with blonde hair and tattoos. After the Air Force marshal returned to the jailhouse, however, Shaver signed a second statement taking full responsibility. Though he still didn't remember anything, he reasoned that he must have done it. One more time, this last paragraph, because this is very important. Investigators interrogated Shaver through the morning. When his wife came to visit, he did not recognize her. He gave his first statement at 10:30 a.m., adamant that another man was responsible. He could summon an image of a stranger with blonde hair and tattoos. After the Air Force marshal returned to the jailhouse, however, Shaver signed a second statement taking full responsibility. Though he still didn't remember anything, he reasoned that he must have done it. 2 months later, in September, Shaver's memories still had not returned. The base hospital commander told Jolly West to perform an evaluation. Was Shaver legally sane at the time of the murder? Shaver spent the next 2 weeks under West's supervision, subject to copious psychological tests. They returned to the scene of the crime, trying to jog his memory. Later, West hypnotized Shaver and gave him an injection of sodium pentothal, truth serum, to see if he could clear his amnesia. While Shaver was under, with West injecting more truth serum to, quote, deepen the trance, unquote, Shaver recalled the events of that night. He confessed to killing Horton. She had brought out repressed memories of his cousin, Beth Rainboat, unquote, who'd sexually abused him as a child. Shaver had started drinking at home that night when he, quote, had visions of God who whispered into his ear to seek out and kill the evil girl Beth, unquote. This Beth was never sought for questioning. At the trial, West argued that Shaver's truth serum confession was more valid than any other, and West was testifying for the defense. They'd hoped he could get an acquittal on temporary insanity. Instead, West's testimony helped the prosecution. Here was a psychiatric expert who believed wholeheartedly that Shaver had committed the crime and who had gotten him to admit it in colorful detail. While West maintained that the airman had suffered a bout of temporary insanity, he also said that Shaver was, quote, quite sane now, unquote. In the courtroom, he didn't look that way. One newspaper account said he, quote, sat through the strenuous sessions like a man in a trance, unquote, saying nothing, never rising to stretch or to smoke, though he was a known chain smoker, quote, Some believe it is an act, unquote, the paper said. Others believe his demeanor is real, unquote. West often treated Lackland airmen for neurological disorders. During the trial, it came out that Shaver had suffered from migraines so debilitating that he dunked his head in a bucket of ice water when he felt one coming on. He sought regular treatment, and the Air Force had recommended him for a 2-year experimental program. One more time. West often treated Lackland airmen for neurological disorders. During the trial, it came out that Shaver suffered from migraines so debilitating that he would dunk his head in the bucket of ice water when he felt one coming on. He sought regular treatment, and the Air Force had recommended him for a 2-year experimental program. The doctor who attempted to recruit him was never named. Shaver's medical history was scrutinized at trial, but little mention was made of the base hospital, Wilford Hall, where West had conducted his MK-Ultra experiments on unwitting patients. On the stand, West said he'd never gotten around to seeing whether Shaver had been treated there. I checked. Lackland officials told me there was no record of Shaver in their master index of patients. But, curiously, all of the records for patients in 1954 had been maintained with one exception. The file for last names beginning with S.A. through S.T. had vanished. Obviously, that would include Shaver. Continuing. Articles and court testimony described Shaver's mental state just as West had described his experiments the previous summer. Amnesias and trance states, a man violating his moral code with no memory of doing so. And West had written that he planned to do an experiment on Lackland airmen for projects that, quote, must eventually be put to test in practical trials in the field, unquote. This was all the more difficult to ignore after I got the transcript of Shaver's Truth Serum interview. West had used leading questions to walk the entranced Shaver through the crime. Quote, tell me about when you took your clothes off, Jimmy, he said, and tried to prove that Shaver had repressed memories. Jimmy, do you remember when something like this happened before, unquote, or after you took your clothes off, what did you do, unquote. I never did take your clothes off, Shaver said. The interview was divided into thirds. The middle third, for some reason, was not recorded. When the record picked up, the transcript said, Shaver is crying. He has been confronted with all the facts repeatedly. One more time, notice the missing records, S.A. through S.T., in the Lackland Air Force files. The interview was divided into thirds. The middle third, for some reason, was not recorded. When the record picked up, the transcript said, Shaver is crying. He has been confronted with all the facts repeatedly, unquote. West asked, now you remember it all, don't you, Jimmy? Yes, sir, Shaver replied. For West, this seems to have been business as usual, but it left an indelible mark on the psychiatrists who worked with him. One of them, Gilbert Rose, R-O-S-E, was so baffled by the Shaver case that he went on to write a play about it. When I reached Rose by phone in 2002, he said Shaver still haunted him. In my 50 years in the profession, he said at the Truth Serum interview, that was the most dramatic moment ever when he clapped his hands to his face and remembered killing the girl, unquote. But Rose was shocked when I told him that West had hypnotized Shaver in addition to giving him sodium pentothal. After I read Rose's citations from articles, reports, and the transcript, he seemed to accept it, but he was adamant that West had never said anything. Hypnotism was not part of the protocol. He'd also never know how West found out about the case right away. Quote, we were involved from the first day, Rose recalled. Jolly phoned me the morning of the murder, Rose said, giving me flashbacks to Shirok Hatami's memory of Reeve Whitson. He initiated it, unquote. West may have shielded himself from scrutiny, but he made only a minimal effort to exonerate Shaver. The airman was found guilty. Though an appeals court ruled that he'd had an unfair trial, he was convicted again in the retrial. In 1958, on his 33rd birthday, he was executed by the electric chair. He maintained his innocence the whole time. West claimed he was in the courtroom the day Shaver was sentenced to death. Around this time, he became vehemently against capital punishment. I couldn't help but wonder if this was because he knew his experiments might have led to the execution of an innocent man and the death of a child. What if his correspondence with Gottlieb, predating the crime by just a year, had been presented at trial? Would the outcome have been the same? Well, of course it wasn't. Note that when Shaver's wife came to visit him in jail, he didn't recognize her. The fact that the interview with Shaver, the middle third for some reason, was not recorded. Note the missing files and the very strange behavior of Shaver saying that a stranger with blonde hair and tattoos came to mind, and that he didn't take Sherry Jo Horton's clothes off. Again, the evidence points very strongly to Shaver having been an early victim of mind control. We went into the mind control programs that this country has been involved with in AFA programs 5, 6, and 7, and also in a For the Record series that excerpts those same programs. And again, it was Jolly West who was Jack Ruby's psychiatrist and claimed that Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald because he had a brief psychomotor epileptic episode in jail, or in the Dallas jail, that caused him to do that. And that just, as they might say in Texas, that dog won't hunt. Indeed. And so when we hear the bloviating and the chest beating and the wringing of hands about how, Trump's behavior and or those of his fellow Republicans threaten democracy or taint American democracy died decades ago. It had its brains blown all over the back of a limousine in broad daylight just past noon, in Dallas, Texas, on November 22, 1963, Kennedy was not, of course, able to pull the U.S. out of Vietnam. The Vietnam War took place, and ultimately it appears that the anti-Vietnam War movement got their wish. The war came home. This concludes For the Record program number 1163, titled Farewell America, Part 2. This is being recorded on November 17th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.